Hello, this is Tom Scott with the Ford County Record, formerly the Paxton Record, for Wednesday, July 18, 2018. We begin our reading today with an article on the front page entitled, Leaf Burning Banned in City. Paxton. With the burning of leaves now banned in Paxton, city officials are turning their attention to another issue. What to do with all those leaves coming down this fall? Following an hour-long discussion, the Paxton City Council voted 7-0 last Tuesday night, with Alderman H.J. Fleshner absent, to approve an ordinance prohibiting the burning of leaves, effective immediately. In doing so, however, the Aldermen made it known that they are well aware of the potential problems that could come this fall if no solution is in place by that time to remove leaves that will be accumulated in the roughly 2,200 yards in Paxton. Upon the suggestion of Alderman Rob Steiger, the council added language to the ordinance to state that the city will develop a plan to dispose of leaves and present it to the council by the end of September for its approval. This definitely gives us the impetus to come up with good options, said Alderman Mike Wilson, chairman of the council's Public Safety Committee. As stated, the plan to be developed will include alternatives to burning. Among the options discussed was the city buying leaf removal equipment at an estimated cost of $65,000 and having city workers go around town and pick up leaves using it. Alternatively, the city could hire private lawn care service to do the work. The idea was also broached about the city possibly paying half of the fees residents would be charged if they could hire a private lawn care service themselves. The latter option would be considerably less expensive for the city than the first two, officials said. If the city were to buy the equipment, it would require two employees of the Public Works Department to operate the machine, likely meaning at least one more employee would need to be hired for the Public Works Department. Under any scenario, it appears likely the leaves would be taken to the city's burn pile located behind the water treatment plant along Pitt Road, just south of Paxton. There, the leaves could either be turned into mulch or burned. LeClaire, however, said that burning leaves at the burn pile is not technically allowed per Illinois Environmental Protection Agency rules, and Mayor Bill Ingold also noted that the burn pile will already be pretty full in the upcoming year, with the expected removal of more than 300 ash trees in Paxton plagued by the emerald ash borer. Ingold said a suitable disposal method will need to be worked out. The banning of leaf burning was the result of concerns among aldermen and residents about the health hazards associated with it. Two residents voiced their concerns about how burning leaves can be harmful to persons affected with asthma in particular. Dustin Frankie, who lives at 956 East Orleans Street, said that one of his three children has asthma and that a leaf burning ban would help protect her and other children from harmful smoke. Frankie, a Paxton Buckley Loda High School cross country and track coach, also noted that his athletes rely on having clean air to perform at their best. Last night, when my athletes were running in Paxton, we tacked on probably a quarter mile to a half mile on a route, dodging smoke on the northwest side of town, he said. Sally Ellis said her daughter Evie has been an avid runner since she was 8 years old. Ellis said her daughter also has asthma, noting that leaf smoke is one of the worst things for my daughter as far as problems with getting air into her lungs. During track season and cross-country season, it can definitely prohibit her from performing at her peak ability. It can slow her down. It can take her completely out, Ellis said. Leaf smoke, for her, is dangerous, and I don't want to have to take her to a hospital after a race. I don't want her to stop running. I want her to be able to live in an environment where people are concerned about the safety of our children. Meanwhile, Dean Geiken, who lives at 309 East Pell Street, says he is not a fan of the leaf-burning ban. Geiken said burning leaves, which he said he does only a couple of times each fall, and only when the wind allows it, not to be a problem for his neighbors, is a more efficient disposal method than bagging them. I can appreciate people who have asthma, but I don't burn leaves on a regular basis, and I try really to do it on a day the wind goes up, Geiken said. Both Geiken and his wife Cordelia said that if the city were to ban the burning of leaves, the city also ought to come up with a list of options residents could turn to as a resource for getting rid of their leaves in a legal fashion. I want to know who's going to come rake my leaves or pick them up out of my yard or what I can do with them, Dean Gyken said. I don't necessarily want to put them in the back of my truck and haul them somewhere. Dean Gyken asked if the city could provide residents with a leaf pickup service similar to the city's regularly scheduled brush pickup. If not, residents may just decide to sweep their leaves to the curb and leave the city to deal with disposing them, said the Gyken's neighbor, Debbie Chapman Herman. But that's against the law, the mayor pointed out. Some 10 residents voiced their views to the council last Tuesday, a larger-than-normal crowd for a single topic. Many were there to express their concerns about media reports that seemed to indicate the council was considering banning recreational fires, too. Wilson, whose committee met 5 days earlier to discuss proposed burning regulations, said it was never the intent of the council to ban recreational fires, and he was disappointed by the misleading information from the media following the committee meeting. Frankly, I will never vote for an ordinance that bans recreational fires, Wilson said. It's unfortunate that that was how it was kind of portrayed, when that definitely was not how the discussion flowed that night, and it was never our intent. As originally drafted, the proposed ordinance presented last Tuesday, however, contained language that would have limited what residents could do to build the recreational fires. Specifically, the ordinance would have made it illegal to burn branches of less than 2 inches in diameter, along with green or fresh wood and other landscape waste material. That language was removed after residents raised concerns about such regulations. I just think it gets kind of hairy when you can't burn sticks, said Brandon Majors, a resident of 940 East Patton Street. In addition to the burning of leaves, the ordinance prohibits the burning of any rubbish, garbage, paper, or other combustible material, as well as the use of burn barrels to burn waste. A first violation of the ordinance can result in a $50 fine, with a $200 fine for each subsequent offense. If an illegal fire continues beyond 1 day, each additional day constitutes a separate violation. Wilson said the council had discussed banning the burning of leaves several times in the past 15 to 20 years, but took no action. In Wilson's time on the council, he said, he gets far more comments from his constituents in support of such a ban than any other topic. Wilson said he would like to see a decision made to end the discussion. All 7 aldermen present, along with the mayor, said they supported a leaf-burning ban, but suggested postponing a vote until after the city can first come up with some possible solutions to remove and dispose of residents' leaves. City officials said they need a solution in place before this fall so that leaves do not accumulate too much and end up clogging up the city's storm drains. Gary Kingery, a resident of 631 West State Street, suggested the council research what other towns are doing before coming to a decision it may end up regretting. However, Steiger said it is not a complicated issue that requires more research. Steiger said the only issue is that the city needs to come up with the money to take on mitigation measures to get rid of the leaves. Steiger then suggested adding language to the ordinance to ensure the public that the city would develop a plan by the fall. I'm not saying that we have to do it in any certain way, Steiger told his fellow aldermen. All I'm saying is that by adding that language, we're telling ourselves that it has to be done. Turning to news from the Gibson City Melvin Sibley School Board, Superfan leaves $136,045 to school district. Gibson City. Longtime Gibson City sports superfan Roy Romer left behind a legacy of dedication and support when he died from cancer in October. Now, that legacy includes one of the largest financial gifts ever given to the Gibson City Melvin Sibley School District. Superintendent Jeremy Darnell announced at Monday night school board meeting that Mr. Romer left $136,045 to the school district. The district will receive 16.67% of Mr. Romer's estate, with other local organizations receiving part of the estate as well. It is the biggest one I've ever seen since I've been at GCMS, Darnell said, noting that large donations are either $4,000 to $8,000 on average. I can't think of, nor have I ever heard, any other six-figure donation to the school district. Born and raised in the Chicago suburbs, Mr. Romer, commonly known by only his first name, moved to Gibson City area when his father purchased farmland in Dix Township in the early 1970s. Around that time, Mr. Romer began attending Gibson City High School sporting events, something he would continue doing up until the weeks prior to his death. It is estimated that Mr. Romer attended more than 3,000 local sporting events, ranging from GCMS high school games to youth baseball and junior high athletics. Mr. Romer was also the longtime bingo caller at the Gibson Area Hospital Annex. A 2016 inductee into the school district's Athletic Hall of Fame, Romer was also honored as Gibson City's Citizen of the Year in 2004 and was a 2011 inductee into the Illinois Basketball Coaches Association Hall of Fame as a friend of basketball. As for what GCMS plans to do with its substantial monetary gift, Darnell said he hopes to contribute it to the ward the athletics or activities, both passions of Roy's. We're going to do something with that money that reflects what Roy's passions were, Darnell said. We'll hope to find something to invest in, either activities or athletics for kids, because that's what Roy enjoyed. He was at every game possible that he could be at, home or away. We're hoping to use that in something that would respect him the most. Now, a story dated Tuesday, July 17th. Lake Iroquois done with cleanup after fish kill, now awaiting test results. Lake Iroquois. Lake Iroquois officials still aren't sure what caused the death of thousands of fish in the lake near Loda on a recent weekend. However, after 2.5 days of cleanup, the lake and its wildlife appear to be returning to normal. I noticed last night that from my patio, the lake was a nice blue color, and we are seeing fish swimming and turtles, Lake Iroquois resident Jim Sherrill said Tuesday. And I attribute all of that to the quick response of our volunteers and their hard work over 2.5 days to get the dead fish cleaned up. Cheryl, chairman of the Lake Iroquois Association's Board Recreation Committee, said the cleanup was finished last Wednesday morning. It began shortly after the fish kill was discovered around 6:30 a.m. Sunday, July 8th. Lake Iroquois officials on Tuesday were still waiting to receive test results from the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency to determine what caused the fish kill. An inspector for the IEPA collected water samples of the lake last week, and Sherrill said Tuesday that he expects the results to be known in the next week to 10 days. Sherrill said last week that, as best as we can determine, the fish kill was caused by the fish not getting enough oxygen due to a phenomenon called inversion, also known as lake turnover. Sherrill noted that following the fish kill, the lake's water appeared very muddy, which lines up with the theory. Meanwhile, Sherrill said routine testing of the water by the Illinois Department of Public Health, the IDPH, shows there are no E. coli bacteria issues in the lake. Lake Iroquois received test results Monday from the IDPH. We have a swimming beach at the lake, and we normally have the water tested every week to make sure the water is safe for swimming, Sherrill said. But since we had the fish kill, we're going to send samples in a couple of times a week for a while. Despite receiving good water test results from the IDPH this week, no swimming is allowed at the lake yet. The swimming beach will not be open for swimming, even though we got one good test, Sherrill said. We want at least one more, maybe two, before reopening it for swimming. Now an article dated Thursday, July 19th. State EPA officials blame Lake Iroquois fish kill on lake turnover. Lake Iroquois. Illinois Environmental Protection Agency field staff believe the naturally occurring lake turnover was to blame for thousands of fish dying at Lake Iroquois on a recent weekend, an agency spokesman said. Testing of water samples from the lake near Loda detected very low levels of the herbicide atrazine, but otherwise came up clean, said IPEA Public Information Officer Kim Briggs. The samples were tested for pesticides and showed no detect for all parameters with the exception of atrazine, Biggs said in an email Wednesday. The atrazine detected was at very low levels and well below both the maximum concentration level for drinking water and the aquatic life use attainment levels that have been established. Given the results, it is the opinion of our field staff that the fish kill likely resulted of lake turnover, which is naturally occurring. Jim Sherrill, chairman of the Lake Iroquois Association's Board Recreation Committee, had said previously that he believed the July 8th fish kill was caused by the fish not getting enough oxygen due to lake turnover. Sherrill noted that the lake's water appeared very muddy, which lines up with the theory. Sherrill said routine testing of the water by the Illinois Department of Public Health showed there are no E. coli bacteria issues in the lake. Still, no swimming is allowed yet. The swimming beach will not be open for swimming, even though we got one good test from the IEPA, Sherrill said. We want at least one more, maybe two, before reopening for swimming. Now from Gibson City. Settlement tentatively reached in tax appeal case. Gibson City. After almost a decade spent fighting its annual property tax assessment in cases that have cost the City of Gibson City and the Gibson City Melvin Sibley School District more than $1 million in legal fees, One Earth Energy has reached a tentative settlement on its property values. In an agreement that was approved by the school board and city council Monday night, the ethanol plant on Gibson City's west side has agreed to a $12 million assessment for the 2018 tax year and $10,790,000 for 2009, with assessments gradually increasing in the years in between. It's been part of an ongoing conversation and dialogue between the two parties, and we came to a conclusion that we thought was fair to everyone, GCMS Superintendent Jeremy Darnell said. No one is winning and no one is losing. It's just a fair compromise. Per the terms of the settlement, One Earth Energy Ethanol Plant will be assessed at $10,797,820 in years 2009 to 2011, $11,257,820 for years 2012 to 2014, and $11,527,000 in 2015, and exactly $12 million for the past 2 years. One Earth Energy has also agreed to forego any assessment disputes for the remainder of the life of its tax increment financing district, which ends in 2039. For each year of its assessment, the ethanol plant is being assessed a base land value of $151,730, with the remainder coming via improvements to the property, which starts at $10,646,090 in 2009 and increases slightly in the years when the assessments will continue. In the future, One Earth Energy's annual assessment will increase as a result of real property improvements made during the previous year per the agreement. In addition, One Earth Energy will be required to report property improvements and approximate costs to both the city and the school district. Darnell said One Earth Energy might pay different amounts in different years based on the specific circumstances. Darnell stressed that the agreement has only been agreed to in principle and there are still many fine details to be worked out. Darnell added that the school district, city, and One Earth Energy will release a statement to the public once the final agreement is settled. As for the timetable of that settlement, Darnell said he hopes it will be finished in time for the school board's August 20 meeting. While GCMS is losing out on the revenue from One Earth Energy's first assessed values, which were higher than $20 million each year, it will receive something in return, as the city has agreed to pay GCMS 10% of One Earth Energy's property taxes each year, which brings the school district's amount to 40% instead of 30%. Darnell said the 10% deal is part of the ethanol's plant, TIF district. Darnell said increasing the district's allotted amount to 40% would nearly make up for the loss of further future property taxes based on the initial agreements assessments. Former GCMS Superintendent Anthony Galindo said during his tenure that the district would lose about $500,000 each year based on what One Earth Energy wanted its assessment to reduce to. Each year, since 2009, the ethanol plant has filed an appeal of its property assessment value with the Ford County Board of Review, seeking to have its assessment lowered to below $10 million. The case ended up going before the state's Property Tax Appeals Board. An administrative law judge heard arguments in the case but had not reached a ruling before the tentative agreement was reached. GCMS has spent upwards of $1 million on attorney fees through a suburban Chicago law firm which represented it at the state level. Darnell said the school district was defending the county's initial assessments in order to try and receive tax revenue. Darnell said that each taxing body would need to okay the deal before it is finalized. Still, Darnell said that since the settlement was reached out of court, he feels that it was fair. "It's been going on for 9 years, and it's been a big deal for everyone," Darnell said. "I think if we can come to a settlement where everyone feels like it's fair, which I think we're all in agreement about, then I think it's going to be good for everyone involved." We'll now turn to the obituaries in the Ford County Record for Wednesday, July 18, 2018. Barbara Bertram, Roberts. Barbara Bertram, 83, of Roberts, formerly of Melvin, died at 4:15 a.m. Saturday, July 14, 2018, at her home in Roberts. A memorial service will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, July 21st, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Roberts, with the Reverend Priscilla Gerdes officiating. Burial will follow at the Chatsworth Cemetery in Chatsworth. Memorials may be made to Melvin Roberts Fire and Rescue, Hospice Hearts, or Transitions to Hospice. Dixie Lee Bloom, Mariana, Florida. Dixie Lee Bloom, 82, formerly of Paxton, died Wednesday, July 11, 2018, at Signature Healthcare at the Courtyard in Mariana, Florida. She resided with her husband Lee in Fountain, Florida, prior to her death. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Michael Bowlesy Bowles, Gibson City. Michael Bowlesy Bowles, 58, of Gibson City, formerly of Lexington, died at 11:20 a.m. Tuesday, July 17, 2018, at his home in Gibson City. Visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, July 21st, at Lamb Funeral Home in Gibson City, followed by a graveside service at Blue Mound Cemetery in Cooksville. A celebration of his life will follow at the Long Branch in Cooksville. Jean M. Bauer, Crescent City. Jean M. Bauer, 73, of Crescent City, sister of a Cisna Park resident, died Saturday, July 14, 2018, at her home. A funeral mass was celebrated Thursday, July 19, at St. Edmund Catholic Church in Watseka, with burial with the Reverend Michael Powell officiating. Burial followed at the St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Kentland. Memorials may be made to masses or to the American Cancer Society. Charlene Harms, Steger. Charlene Harms, née Nordbrook, 86, of Steger, mother of a Paxton resident, died peacefully on Tuesday, July 17, 2018. Visitation will be from 3 to 8 p.m. Friday, July 20th, at Steger Memorial Chapel in Steger. Visitation will also be from 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, July 21st, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Chicago Heights. A funeral service will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, July 21st, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Interment will follow at the St. Paul's Lutheran Cemetery in Flossmoor. Memorials may be made to St. Paul's Lutheran Church or Christ Lutheran High School in Buckley. Ronald Ray, R.J. Jackson, Danville. Ronald Ray, R.J. Jackson, 76, of Danville, father of a Paxton resident, died Friday, July 13, 2018, at Great River Hospice House. In lieu of flowers, a memorial to the family has been established and may be sent in care of Lunning Chapel, Burlington, Iowa. Keith Lamb, Pontiac. Keith T. Lamb, 90, of Pontiac, formerly of Cabery, died at 7:45 p.m., Saturday, July 7, 2018, at OSF St. James John W. Albrecht Medical Center in Pontiac. A mass of Christian burial was held on Thursday, July 12, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Campus, with Father Chris Hake officiating. Memorial contributions may be made to the Cullum Junior Fair. Janice L. Marshall, Paxton. Janice L. Marshall, 73, of Paxton, died at 10:34 a.m., Friday, July 13, 2018, at Heritage Health in Gibson City. A memorial service was held on Tuesday, July 17, at the Bear Funeral Services, with the Reverend John Houck officiating. Memorial tributes may be made to the First United Methodist Church in Paxton, St. Jude's Children's Hospital, or an organization of the donor's choice. Evelyn Rattenberg, Paxton. Evelyn M. Evie Rattenberg, 93, of Paxton, died at 10:31 p.m., Tuesday, July 10, 2018, at Accolade Paxton Senior Living. Funeral services were held Friday, July 13th at Bear Family Funeral Services in Paxton, with the Reverend Deborah Dormeyer officiating. Burial followed in Glen Cemetery in Paxton. Memorials may be made to Christ Lutheran High School in Buckley. Elizabeth R. Shepherd, Rankin. Elizabeth R. Shepherd, a graduate of Rankin High School, died Wednesday, July 11, 2018, at Glen Haven in Glenwood City, Wisconsin, surrounded by family. A memorial service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, July 21st, at Boyceville United Methodist Church, with the Reverend Shannon Madison officiating. Visitation will be from 10:15 to 11 a.m. Saturday, July 21st, at the church. Her wish was to rest eternally beside her husband Jean at the Rankin Union Cemetery in Rankin, and she will do so on Saturday, July 28th. Somchai and Amporn Supanowich, Gibson City. Somchai and Amporn Supanowich passed away in peace within 6 months of each other this year. Amporn died of heart failure associated with surgery on February 26th, and Somchai died of pancreatic cancer on June 30th. Loving companions until the end, they were never apart for very long. A private family ceremony was held for both Somchai and Amporn. Gifts and honorariums should be directed towards the Gibson Area Hospital Foundation. They would have also been very pleased with those who could help water plants in the public gardens in their honor. Returning to the news, Gibson City Railroad Crossing to be closed in early August. Gibson City. The 8th Street Railroad Crossing in Gibson City will be closed to traffic as repairs to the crossing are made between Monday, August 6th and Friday, August 17th. The city made the announcement on its Facebook page Monday after being informed of the project by the Bloomer Line Railroad. And that's all the time we have for today's reading of the Ford County Record. Just a reminder that this and all our weekly paper readings can be found on our website by Googling Illinois Radio Reader and also on the Ciro app under reading services for your smartphone. This is Tom Scott. I look forward to reading with you again soon.